Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Martin again with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I wanted to start off by letting you know, as I did on Monday, that I will be away next week for both Monday and Thursday, although I will be recording tomorrow two new shows for your enjoyment. And just remember, please, not to call in with questions because there won't be anybody to answer them. But I will be talking on Monday quite a lot about the Federal Reserve in answer to a listener's question. So should be interesting, hopefully, and some of you will have heard parts of it before, but basically I try to give it a new twist every time I talk again about a particular subject, and this will be no exception. I need to talk a little bit more about what I announced to you on Monday about stable value funds. I've been getting a lot of emails from people who are now kind of panicking because they indeed have stable value funds as their investment of cash equivalent. As I told you, there are really only a few alternatives out there. You can have money market funds, both commercial and treasury, and you can have these stable value funds, which really plays on insurance contracts. And what I said on Monday was that I felt that the time had come for those who had contacted your administrators, your plan administrators, your 401k plan administrators, about getting a treasury bill money market fund into the plan without success, who had the stable value funds, the time had come to liquidate the 401k plan. And the problem appears to be that not only can they not get the treasury bill money market funds, but that the administrators are refusing to allow them to cash in their 401ks because they say they have to hold them until they leave the company or for hardship events. Well, this is a gray area. It's really a mixture of the retirement plan people, the 401k plan people, and also the Department of Labor, who has an input into this. And apparently, you can take out your money for the hardship events and not necessarily have to pay the penalty. But if you're trying to argue with your administrator about as to whether you can actually take the money out just because you feel like it, you may find you're going to have a hard uphill battle with that one. There are various events which enable you to take money out of a 401k plan. The best thing, I think, for you to do is to establish which of those events are acceptable to the particular plan that your company has signed up for, and then try to organize an exit from the plan based on one of those events. I mean, that's probably going to be the simplest way for you to do that. The idea that you do or don't have the legal right to take your money out at will is going to take too long to argue, in my opinion. Probably become expensive too, so you have to bring lawyers into the equation. But I do think that you need to move fairly fast on this one. Also on Monday, I think I spoke to you about a rally, which was the first step in a kind of tax revolt that contained 15,000 people. And it was in Fullerton, California. And I brought this to your attention as being one of the first instances of the incipient wave towards full-scale civic unrest. And I discovered, quite by chance, a very interesting twist to this story, which is that the Los Angeles Times never covered it. Now, Fullerton is not far from L.A. I know Fullerton. I got stopped for speeding in Fullerton about 10 years ago, and I was on my way to downtown L.A. It's very, very close, about sort of 20 minutes, you know, when there's no traffic. Well, it's easily within the purview of the L.A. Times to discuss it as a local issue. This is not in question here. But the L.A. Times felt apparently unwilling to draw attention to a rally which had indeed attracted 15,000 people. There is a letter from the editor of the L.A. Times. I mean, so much fuss was made about that the editor called David Lauter mass-mailed dozens of readers who had written to complain about the lack of coverage. And he said, "Thanks to each of you for writing. I appreciate hearing from all of you, even the ones who called me a moron." The point of his letter was to counter the 15,000 attendees event and the claim that his paper had not covered it. And his letter actually uncritically represents the apparently more objective estimate given by a Fullerton police sergeant, who fixed the number between 3,000 and 8,000. Way to nail it down, Sarge. "If the extremely large gap between the extremes of that range suggests to you that the sergeant may perhaps lack expertise in the field of crowd estimation, then congratulations. You've just demonstrated more journalistic skepticism than a trained editor of the major national newspaper." The Times, of course, chose the lowest number out there. Other estimations were much closer, in fact, to the radio station's own claimed 15,000. According to John Fleischman, the Fullerton Police Department estimated the crowd at 15,000 itself. And that citizen journalist also reported the number at 15,000. But the Orange County Police Register estimated it at 8,000. So what are these, different police? Or, you know, you start to get a sense that crowd estimation is not an exact science, don't you? But nevertheless, there were still a lot of people there. So why not write about it? So the editor, the L.A. Times editor, Lauter, says, "Between now and the May 19th election, we plan extensive coverage of both sides of the campaign over the ballot initiatives. We'll explain the issues, tell readers what both sides are saying, figure out where the money is coming to pay for the campaigns on both sides, and show people what's at stake. What we're not likely to do is to cover a lot of individual rallies from either side. That's not a political thing. We don't cover a lot of government worker rallies in favor of tax hikes either. That doesn't mean we're not interested in the issue or that we have any disrespect for the people who attend the rallies or the people who organize them." Yeah, well, noticeably absent, of course, is a denial that he lacks respect for John and Ken. He just says that readers can't draw that conclusion based on the paper's lack of coverage of a rally, because the paper just doesn't cover a lot of rallies. So, well, let's have a look and see if the LA Times does cover a lot of rallies. Well, you bet it does. And they don't have to have 15,000 people either, as long as the issue is one near and dear to the hearts of the Times editors. The Times has, in fact, covered protests and rallies with crowds similar in size to John and Ken's tax protests, including the teachers' rally in Pershing Square with a crowd of around 10,000, or an immigrants' rights march in L.A. with nearly 5,000 immigrants and their supporters, or the immigrants' rights march with 3,000 attendees in Norcross, Georgia. How about the lower end? Well, we saw a story about 50 Teamsters marching into a freight hauler's office to demand that some truckers be reinstated. Laughably, an entertainment feature called The Envelope told us that the critical news that More than a dozen Jews for Peace demonstrated outside the federal building in Westwood, seeking more humanitarian aid for Gaza. The LA Times blogs have covered things as crucially important as Peter's rally, comparing a kennel club to the KKK, and a vigil protesting an Israeli dance troupe. All right, so what's really going on here? Well, a particular reader wrote to Lauter and got a somewhat different response. One that denigrated the rally as a promotional event for radio personalities. The letter, which begins with the same bland boilerplate as the letter that I just mentioned, ends this way: "But while the issues involved are important, rallies by themselves are seldom newsworthy. In an area the size of Southern California, there's a rally, demonstration, or march practically every week somewhere, particularly when a political campaign is underway. We'll make sure that all sides in the debate get covered fairly, but I think that there are better ways to do that than by covering promotional events for radio personalities." Well, that almost suggests disdain for these particular radio personalities. But surely such an event can't prevail at a bastion of objectivity such as the LA Times. Well, the LA Times' James Rainey recently wrote a column dripping with contempt for John and Ken, whom he dismissively termed Ken John, and described as people who seem to like their answers without much nuance. Rainey, of course, is a columnist. His type of snooty attitude could never infuse the decisions made by news editors. They have objective reasons to refuse to cover a tax protest of between 8,000 and 15,000 people while giving space to Peter lunatics, 50 Teamsters, and a baker's dozen of Jews for Gaza and terrorism. Well, anyone who doubts that the editors of the LA Times lack respect for John and Ken, let's hear from you. Anyone who doubts that the contempt editors feel for John and Ken influenced their decision not to cover the rally, let's hear from you too. I doubt that the switchboard will light up today. Well, obviously, the view of the LA Times is that tax increases are, in fact, a good thing. The state needs their money, and we are supposed to rally around and pay it. And they're not inclined to support the minority view on that subject, it appears. Well, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and please call in, as always, with your questions to 888-873-4643. That's our toll-free number. Again, 888-873-4643. And then also write in your questions if you'd like to do that. You can do so by writing to rmartin@latam.inv.com. That's my email address, open for you 24 hours a day to write in questions and opinions. Once more, the email address to write to is rmartin@latam.inv.com. LATAM, Latin American Investments, lataminv.com. Finally, my personal number, which many of you are using, more and more so, I should say now, to ask questions. You may call that, too, at 305-579-2012. Once more, the personal number for you to call me when you have questions and problems and issues is 305-579-2012. Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I must tell you the real reason that I brought this to your attention, and I've spent a little bit of time talking about this business of what's reported and what isn't, is that it just goes to show to what extent the press, the media, does side mindlessly on the side of law and what they call, and like to call euphemistically, law and order, and the status quo. I mean, not talking about this very considerable and important rally is tantamount to ignoring the precepts of Ron Paul, who throughout his campaign was virtually isolated from publicity by the press. And it works. Let's not, beat around the bush here. When the press in this country does not give voice to things which are going on, there is a high chance that those things will lose their impact, lose their momentum, and the press know that, it becomes much harder to make one's point. This is a very clearly a case in point. Make no mistake, the people who organized this are media moguls themselves. There is no question that the LA Times was informed that this rally would have taken place and that they made a specific decision not to attend and to report it. This was not a sin of omission. This was most definitely a sin of committing the decision of ignoring this event. And this will happen. And that's why I say to you that when you do hear of these isolated incidents of civic protest, the chances are that where possible, the major media will attempt to ignore it. So that's really what we're dealing with here. But the news will out one way or the other, because I expect there are lots of other people like myself who do go after this kind of thing. And take care of it. Bring it to your attention. All right. Let me see what we have here. There is an email that came in. And I don't know whether, this is something to do with greed and fear from Rona. I don't have time to study it now, Rona, but I will do so, and I will bring it to the attention of the listeners, maybe on the Monday show. A study came out very recently showing that half Americans now say that they are 1 month or less away from not being able to meet their financial obligations if they were to lose their jobs. That's just two paychecks or less. And of these, more than half, which is 28% of all Americans, say they could not survive financially for more than 2 weeks without their current job. This disturbing data comes courtesy of the 2009 MetLife study of the American Dream, released on Monday, which looks at how the financial crisis has affected the American Dream and consumer perceptions. It's all the more disturbing that considering that unemployment in the U.S. already has surged to 8.1%, with 651,000 jobs lost last month alone. All right, well, I'll talk a little bit more about that, but let's hear from Henry in New York, who's waiting online to talk to us. Hello, Henry. How are you?
Hello, Richard.
Hi.
Yeah, how are you? And hello to all the listeners.
Well, I'm very well. Thank you very much. How about your good self?
Yes, sir. I was reading a very disturbing, I was doing my little investigation into the bailout money that's being used for AIG. And it seems to me that not wanting to disclose who the money is going to, I came across a little bit of information that Goldman Sachs is the main beneficiary to this credit default swap, so-called AIG bailout, in the tune of somewhere around $50 billion almost, but it's being kept a secret.
Well, you're absolutely right, Henry. And in fact, it is a scandal which I think will feed directly into the civic unrest that we are going to see in the near future. I mean, when American taxpayers' money is taken and given to AIG not to support the firm, not to make sure that the firm can, pay out its obligations under its insurance contracts, but simply to pay off its debts to other people, you may wonder how much longer the American people are going to take this lying down. I mean, of course they didn't want to tell you who the beneficiaries were, because they knew that once it was discovered that AIG was simply paying off, their creditors, then it becomes like a scandal of major proportions.
I think it will mushroom, because Henry Paulson and the old Goldman Sachs, alumni have been stealing this, been working this thing for about 2 years. They haven't just been new at it. They've been working this thing for about 2 years. They allowed Lehman to fold for this very reason.
Well, I don't. Yes, exactly. And Goldman Sachs, as it then was discovered, was a major creditor of Lehman. And by the way, Goldman Sachs was the only financial institution allowed in and present at the hearings to decide what to do about this particular problem. Goldman Sachs was, in fact, right there in the room, and they were the only people in the room.
And that's exactly why, because they wanted it because the AIG would have to cover Lehman's debt, the failure of Lehman going bankrupt, and so they would directly benefit.
It's a terrible scandal. I mean, I cannot believe that that experienced financial people would be capable of this. But you know, the greatest tragedy about all this, I mean, looking past the scandal, is that it will never work. I mean, it isn't going to solve the problem. The idea of giving taxpayer money to a failing bank, which itself will use the money to pay off its own debts, is not a way to create a thriving economy. It just pours more fuel on the fire, or if you like more fire on the fire, fire being, you know, what caused the problem in the first place in the form of money, it isn't going to work. And I keep saying this, I mention this on almost every show, that the current idea that this bailout can do anything except prolong the depression is entirely misguided. That's all it can possibly do. And you can look at it from any angle. You can look at it from any historical context that you wish, including the Great Depression of 1933, where Roosevelt went around and did exactly the same thing, making all the same mistakes that people are making today without any reference to what happened in the past, and realizing that it didn't work then. But the whole thing is really just political. No self-respecting business would ever survive under these conditions, and no self-respecting bankruptcy judge would allow such a business to survive under those conditions. And yet, apparently, they have, you know, the government has the right to steal not even money from the taxpayer, because there's no money involved here. It's digital dollars spun out of nowhere and thereby adding to the debt of this country and mortgaging the future of the children. I mean, it's beyond the powers of the imagination to conjure up, frankly. And I thank you very much for drawing our attention to this, Henry. Very good.
Okay, thank you.
Well, coming back to the parlous state of the Americans' finances, notwithstanding money being paid out to satisfy AIG's debts, a Bloomberg News survey of economists, which was released on Tuesday morning, found that economists now expect unemployment levels in the U.S. to reach 9.4% this year alone, which I believe is well under the final tally for the year. And I believe that it will be well over 10%, but we won't know until it happens who's right here. And that these levels will remain elevated through at least 2011, which obviously paints a potentially grim picture for the U.S. economy in general, and, of course, for housing in particular. Traditionally, borrower defaults are driven by macroeconomic factors, such as increased rates of unemployment. The survey data underscores that the mortgage industry would do well to remain focused on economic fundamentals. Following a job loss, 59% of surveyed respondents said that they'd be somewhat or very concerned about having to file for bankruptcy, and 64% would be concerned about losing their home. So you see this knock-on effect, the snowball effect. You know, the unemployment pushes down the foreclosures, which pushes down the unemployment, which pushes down the foreclosures, which is why it's quite impossible for anybody to say with any degree of accuracy how long this nightmare can actually continue. Evidence of the spending binge most Americans are still recovering from is evident even in the broadest sense, not just limited to those with more limited financial means. Even the so-called mass affluent, those making $100,000 plus in income per year, according according to the MetLife study, haven't been saving enough, with more than one quarter saying that they couldn't meet their financial obligations for more than 1 month following a job loss. So, you know, the devastation does not allow itself to be restricted to the poorer middle classes. And, of course, that's the sort of information that should give every lender, investor, and servicer pause as we think about managing a growing number of bad loans. The American dream is on pause, and I continue to quote MetLife here. The majority of Americans still believe that they can still achieve the dream in their lifetimes, but for the next year, it's all about shoring up the foundation of their personal safety nets. And that comes from Beth Hirschhorn at MetLife, Senior Vice President for Global Brand and Marketing Services. For the one-third of Americans who believe they already have achieved the dream, being able to sustain the dream without backsliding is becoming as important as achieving it in the first place. The MetLife study alludes to some amazingly sharp and fast changes in the attitudes of most Americans, the kind of changes that usually take decades to manifest instead of being forced upon an entire population immediately by a financial crisis that has proven to be unlike any other faced by most. For the first time since MetLife fielded the annual study, there is evidence that consumers are no longer interested in keeping up with the proverbial Joneses. Nearly half, 47%, of consumers say that they already have all the possessions they need, up from 34% in November 2006, and a full three-quarters, 70%, no longer agree that the pressure to buy more and better material possessions is greater than ever. And I quote Hirschhorn again. Sweeping changes in the economy have led to a reevaluation of priorities for most Americans and a fundamental shift away from materialism. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that you can see the obvious conclusion to be drawn from this, which is that the American consumer at last is doing what I would have advised from the very beginning, which is to stop consuming, stop spending, look after yourself. Take care of your own needs and leave the fripperies and the impulse buying to other people. This is, of course, however, not good news for the economy, which requires you to go out and spend in order, you know, for the economy to thrive. So it is really a catch-22. The more you read about people not doing these things, the more unlikely it is that the economy will basically thrive in the near or even foreseeable future. Steve Kruger comes in saying, Richard, it is these folks two paychecks away from Chapter 11 that are the very people that will make the most noise in the coming unrest. They are not predisposed to a life of crime, but when you see your kids going hungry, who knows what they're capable of doing? Enjoy your travel, Steve Kruger. Well, thank you, Steve. You know, what I'm trying to do for you is to give you the nuts and bolts of the problem so that at least when you come to understand what's happening and how to place all this in context, you have, you know, some factual information to go on. I think it's probably time for me to read the latest bulletin from our friend Gerald Celente, which came in a few days ago. It's very short, and so I will read it to you. And he says, with an article entitled, "We Will Recover," says Obama. "No, we won't," says Celente. "Government policies doomed to fail," written on the 27th of February. "The wealth of plain hard facts upon which the Trends Research Institute's forecasts are based belie the lofty promises made by President Obama's first address to Congress. We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before," said President Obama. Said Celente, "The government has yet to fix the levees in New Orleans. There is still a hole in the ground where the World Trade Center once stood. Washington has started two wars it can't win and doesn't know how to finish. The massive bank, brokerage, auto, and insurance company bailouts have done nothing to resuscitate the sinking economy. The Troubled Assets Relief Program, TARP, that candidate Obama championed has not relieved President Obama's $787 billion American Recovery and Reinvestment Act will not lead to recovery, and the nation will not emerge stronger than before, Salenti continued. With only a succession of past executive and congressional failures to point to, and with the same people responsible for those failures still holding high office, the belief that this time around it will be miraculously different is nothing less than willful delusion. Tuesday's episode of the presidential reality show was a prime-time exercise in human debasement and self-humiliation, said Salenti. Some lowlights. Congressman Elliot Engel arrived at 8:30 a.m. to secure a prized spot on the House floor for a chance to shake the president's hand on his way to the stage. It's a special treat for me to do it this year, Engel said, adding, it's the office, it's the aura, but it's also the man. Hillary Clinton, America's new superstar Secretary of State, regally acknowledged the dutiful cheers of lesser political lights as she strolled down the House's aisle. Shiny cabinet members and august Supreme Court justices were announced in stentorian tones by a pair of sergeants-at-arms with all the exaggerated pomp of a Groucho Marx send-up of British royalty. And to punctuate the performance, there was the geriatric pom-pom girl Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, repeatedly jumping from her seat, leading her pack of Democratic trained seals in whoops of applause at every repetition of the magic juju words, jobs, prosperity, confidence. And to punctuate the performance, there was, across the aisle, Republicans smirked, mugged, and scowled darkly in their new roles as minority villains. Few GOP hands clapped. That the public as well as the press should take this three-ring spectacle seriously is as depressing an indication of the state of the nation as the empty rhetoric of the speech itself. Meanwhile, back on the planet, in the midst of a global economic crisis, the public continues to pin its hopes on a president, senators, and congressmen willingly participating in such obviously orchestrated buffoonery. How is this even possible? How is such behavior tolerated? Why would anyone look up to these people? In one sense, it is understandable. President Obama's big show was just another typical political performance. From the excesses of Democratic and Republican nominating conventions to photo ops of candidates sitting on bales of hay pretending they're just plain folks to staging whistle stops from vintage trains dragged out of storage especially for the occasion to contrived town hall meetings to the slick and vicious marketing campaigns, the public has come to accept such antics as normal. These political rituals, carefully staged, time-tested and proven, can create an illusion of superiority. President Obama made this distinction clear in Tuesday's speech. I have come here tonight not only to address the distinguished men and women of the great chamber here, but to speak frankly and directly to the men and women who sent us here. Distinguished? Distinguished for what? Having the skills to do whatever they do? No matter how ruthless or degrading, to win elections? Yet the honorific is accepted without question while the implicit patronization of the citizenry slips by unperceived. They are distinguished, and the rest are merely the men and women who sent them there. This is a confidence game. The elaborate staging is designed to inspire the nation's people with confidence that their distinguished leaders have the skills to save them from an economic disaster that both political parties were instrumental in creating. Just days earlier, former President Bill Clinton urged the new president to play the confidence game. I just want the American people to know that he's confident that we're going to get out of this and he feels good about the long run. And that President Obama is hopeful and completely convinced we're going to come through this, Clinton said on national TV. Completely convinced or not in his speech, the newly elected president pitched confidence, repeating the word seven times. It worked. Post-speech polls, the pundits and the press gave the president high marks for his performance. And President Obama, the most distinguished among all those distinguished men and women of this great chamber, established his credentials as America's confidence man in chief. What is a confidence man, and what makes us say President Obama is conning the public? A con man succeeds by gaining the confidence of the victim. In this case, the victim is the taxpayer, who is being shaken down for trillions to bail out too-big-to-fail businesses. The con lies in Obama's assurance.
While the cost of action will be great, I can assure you that the cost of inaction will be greater. The trillions already spent on bailouts and buyouts make it clear the cost of action will be great. It is already great, and it has failed miserably. Why should anyone believe that pouring still more trillions into the same bottomless pit will now somehow prove effective? And why should anyone believe Obama's assurance that the cost of inaction will be far greater? He doesn't know that. Why believe the assurance of the man who failed to recognize the country was in recession until 8 months after the recession began? We forecast the recession well before it happened. We are forecasting the greatest depression. And having analyzed Mr. Obama's speech, promises, and plans, we can forecast, with assurance of our own, that the cost of action will prove far greater than the cost of inaction. While the public, both at home and abroad, express high hopes and great optimism, the global financial markets remain unassured by the assurances and continue to reach new lows. Well, the words of Silenti represent the words of a man who is well known for his accurate predictions. And I must tell you that this one's a doozy. If Silenti is ever listening to this, I must tell him, I say, you've got some time off for the next few years, my friend Jerry. You haven't got any work to do here. The map is laid out for all to see. This is really a simple call. No prizes for getting this one right, I'm afraid. Well, let's see what we have to deal with right now. Okay, let me just look and see. On a blog that I came across the other day, I read an interesting piece, a few lines, which I thought I would bring to your attention. And by the way, for those of you who are still wondering whether to call in and lost the number, it is still 888-873-4643. Let me give it to you once more. 888-873-4643. So, this is what I read, and I thought you might be interested. I worked as a mortgage underwriter for over a decade. I can assure you that in the best of companies, fewer than five and often as few as zero people ever look over a loan for creditworthiness. A reputable loan officer might pay attention to these details, a processor should, and the underwriter specializes in it. Unfortunately, there is no required training or educational level required for any of these positions. With a bachelor's degree from an Ivy League university, I was grossly overqualified. I was the sole signature required to lend approximately $250 million annually on behalf of a major U.S. bank. Most in my position had no more than a high school education. Even that level of education and human review was removed as more and more loans were approved, not by humans, but by automated underwriting systems. As an underwriter, I watched the computer approve hundreds of loans whose credit or income were beyond what any human would even consider approving. Perhaps you will have some luck in collecting the lost funds from a computer. I doubt it. I firmly believe that the crisis, in large part, was caused by this abandoning of human review in favor of flawed computer models. Well, yes, ladies and gentlemen, I would agree with that. Except that, of course, I think there was greed involved as well, which doesn't really come out in all the wash there. But clearly, you know, one of the things which irritates me most about all this is the clamor for new regulations. People say, oh, the regulatory authorities didn't have enough to go with. We need more more embracing regulations. Absolutely untrue. Ladies and gentlemen, I have mentioned this time and time again. There were more than enough regulations on the books for people like Greenspan to have prevented all of these things happening, starting with the internet bubble back in the late 90s. It could all have been stopped at a stroke by Greenspan unilaterally, bringing in and applying the laws and the regulations on the books specifically designed to prevent that. And of course, the greatest crime of all, with of course Greenspan's approval, the breakdown of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated banks and banking activities from investment activities. And of course, once that rule was broken, I'm going to be talking a lot more about that probably on next Thursday's show. I haven't prepared the talk yet, but I think I'm going to be talking about this more in a week's time. The whole idea that people were now apparently capable of integrity to segregate the deposits of banking depositors from those of the investment community is, of course, not even called for. Banks are supposed to invest the deposits of its depositors, but not in internet stocks or in derivatives. The regulations are all there, ladies and gentlemen. We didn't need more regulations. It's just nonsense. It's the regulator's excuse, and of course everybody laps it up like kittens. The excuse being that there wasn't enough, you know, for these poor regulators to do, that they sat anguished while these things were happening because there simply wasn't any way in which they could prevent it. Absolute nonsense. Hogwash from beginning to end. Interesting article that came up from Bill Bonner, who I read every day in his dailyreckoning.com, and well worth your time, just to read what he has to write. Forget all the advertising, all the hype that his henchmen in Baltimore have found it convenient to pepper his brilliant comments with. Just ignore all that and just read what he has to say every day. It's well worthwhile. I came across one article that I couldn't resist bringing to your attention today. It seemed really to sum it all up very, very nicely, as he does. It's concerned with, you know, negative growth, which of course is a euphemism for when you don't have growth, you can't have negative growth. But you'll see the papers plastering that expression everywhere, hoping that people will assume that that sort of means some kind of illicit growth, which can turn into the real thing somewhere down the line. Anyway, here we go. Negative growth, says today's paper. Yes, dear reader, stocks are advancing to the rear, and economies are growing smaller. How we love these oxymorons. If only we could age negatively and eat all we wanted and gain minus pounds. The commentators have it all wrong. Look on the bright side. The world economy is not in a period of negative growth. It's in a period of positive collapse. That's why the Great Depression was so great, after all. What's positive about this depression is that it is clearing away a generation's worth of mistakes, misallocations of resources, and misplaced confidence. Stocks are down more than 20% this year. The U.S. economy is retreating at more than 6% this year. Britain is walking backwards at a 2% pace. And Japan? Wow, when it comes to negative growth, the Japanese are experts. Their economy is growing negatively at more than 12% per year. If this keeps up, by the time the next bull market comes along, there won't be any Japanese economy left. The Asian Development Bank says the losses so far have cost the world $50 trillion. The last estimate of the total world's wealth we saw was $100 trillion. If these estimates are correct, the planet has lost about half its value. But who bids for planet Earth? Just about everything else that existed, the real wealth of the world, still exists. What disappeared were the fantasy financial evaluations. A truck is a truck is a truck. It doesn't become less of a truck just because the world has entered a period of financial contraction. It is just as serviceable now as it was 2 years ago. And the poor guy who had a trucking company keeps on trucking. But now he has a whole lot less trucking to do than he did before. The stores aren't moving as much merchandise, so no need to deliver so much. And so the value of his truck, in terms of how much revenue it can produce, has gone down. So too has the value of his trucking company. Maybe he never should have bought that truck in the first place. So far, the Dow has wiped out 43 years of gains. Adjusted for inflation, it was at this level back when the Beach Boys and the Beatles were just starting out. Actually, we don't remember when the Beach Boys and the Beatles began, but it must have been in the mid-60s. Back in 66, the Dow hit a high for the cycle. It had been going up since the bottom in 1949. After the peak in 66, it retreated and then staged another attack on the summit 2 years later. But inflation was getting pumped up too, and in real terms, the 68 high failed to better the peak of 66. From 66 to 82, it was down, down, down. Then Business Week threw in the towel. The death of equities, said the cover story. Then it was up, up, up until, well, you remember the rest. We only bring this up to warn readers. These major cycles take time. So far, the Dow has only gotten down to the 66 top. Now it has to get to the 82 bottom, adjusted for inflation. Where would that be? Well, as we recall, the Dow was barely at 1,000 when the bull market began, and if adjust that to consumer price inflation, we come to a 2,000 to 3,000. Will it get there? Who knows? The company that Thomas Edison started cut its dividend for the first time in 71 years. Some analysts think GE could default too, thanks to the company's move into the financial sector. Hotels are going into foreclosure too, says USA Today. The Dow Chemical is trading at a 24-year low. And the great red hope, the idea that China will pull the entire world economy out of a depression, is pure fantasy, writes William Pisek. China relies on exports, and the export business sucks. It will be lucky to get through this downturn without a revolution. An Economist headline, are investors still too optimistic? Our guess, yes. Most of the action on the stock markets is professional buying and selling. The amateurs seem to be largely sitting on the sidelines, waiting for a rebound to get back in. They still haven't gotten the message. This isn't a recession. There won't be a quick recovery, and the bailout stimulus plans won't work. This is depression. It will take years to restructure the economy, and bailout stimulus plans just slow down the process. Looking back at the Dow, if you take the market peak of January 2000 as the long-term cyclical top, you might expect an eventual bottom 10 to 20 years later, and then a new bull market that would return prices to their peak highs 10 to 20 years after that. Between the high of 29 and the next major high in 66 was 37 years. Between the 66 high and the 2000 high was 34 years. So sit back, relax. Most likely we'll see stock prices much lower for much longer. Look for a turn to the 2000 highs in 2035. Learn to make a correction your friend. Remember, this is a positive collapse, not negative growth. It is correcting the stupid growth of the bubble years. What really grew during that period was consumer spending in the United States and Britain, and it grew far beyond the ability of Anglo-Americans to pay for it. Because they were spending too much, the whole world economy bent to sell them too much. The Chinese built too many factories. The shippers built too many vessels. The truckers bought too many trucks. The home builders put up too many hovels. The retailers expended too much. The malls were overbuilt, etc., etc., etc. Now, in this period of positive collapse, all that surplus capacity is being marked down to what it's really worth, liquidated and restructured. Give it time, dear reader. Let Mr. Market do his work. Fine commentary, if I say so myself. Carol from Cleveland is on the line. Cleveland, Ohio, Carol, come in with your comment, question, report, whatever it be. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I was wondering your thoughts on that shill, that's my opinion, Jim Cramer of CNBC, the recent revelation through his own braggadocio regarding manipulating his derivatives fund, and he's denying any illegality. Tonight he'll be on with Stewart. What do you think about this?
Well,
thank you.
Carol, did you see the John Stewart report on Jim Cramer the other day?
Yes, it was emailed to me from some friends, and I did see part of it.
Yeah, I actually emailed it out to my email distribution list.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, it would have been amusing if it wasn't so grotesque.
Truly.
This man had basically claimed that Bear Stearns, the Bear Stearns people wouldn't be in trouble. And John Stewart picked up on that and said that Jim Cramer had said a few days before Bear Stearns collapsed that Bear Stearns wouldn't collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Stewart then got a notification from Cramer saying that he'd been misrepresented. Cramer was referring to the clients of Bear Stearns, those who had investments with Bear Stearns. They would be okay, whatever happened to Bear Stearns itself, which is true that he'd said that. And John Stewart apologized for misquoting him. But then John Stewart went on to say, but 5 days before that, Jim Cramer had said that indeed Bear Stearns was a good investment in itself prior to the collapse.
Yes,
weeks before that, he'd again, in answer to somebody's question, said that this was a great investment to have.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my take on this, quite frankly, Carol, is that the arrogance of Jim Cramer coming in and complaining that he was misrepresented, thinking that that John Stewart would never have the research capabilities to go back over his shows a few days, a few weeks earlier, finding things that really did claim Jim Cramer had said that Bear Stearns was okay as an investment. He thought he could just sort of get away with it. Because if he hadn't thought that, he would never have complained to John Stewart that he'd been misrepresented, because he would have been too fearful that the real misrepresentation would have come out in the wash. I mean, that's arrogance of the first order, it seems to me. And just points to where, you know, Wall Street feels that it can do no wrong. Even when it does wrong, even when it can be proved that it did wrong, it likes to kind of make out that it did no wrong at all. And he is absolutely not alone in this. I mean, he's just symptomatic. He is the entertainment shill for the grand mass of people who today, quite frankly, are sitting back, heaving with laughter at the fact that they've made all this money while, you know, the world is going bankrupt at their specific expense. And so, frankly, you couldn't ask for a more reliable representative of Wall Street than Jim Cramer coming on TV and making fun of the whole thing. I mean, it's really just so outrageous. Does that sort of answer your question, Cal?
Well, my question was more pointedly directed to Jim Cramer during an interview. It's on YouTube, actually bragging about manipulating his fund, possibly to the detriment of the fund holders, and also stating that the SEC and would not do anything about it because the SEC was asleep at the switch. And the point of this of my question was your thoughts regarding the illegality and the criminality of this creature.
Well, I mean, Jim Cramer is a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if he actually practiced law before moving into financial services themselves, mm-hmm. I think it's fairly clear to me that he is among the more intelligent of the operators on Wall Street, and I very much doubt that Jim Cramer himself would have done anything illegal mm-hmm. In the way that he operated his fund. He, more than anybody, is aware of the rules and regulations governing investments. And his genius goes beyond that. I mean, he's just a manipulator of the system in the way in which so many of them were. And what, as I had said earlier in the show, Carol, today, the way to deal with this would have been to apply the rules and the regulations which were in place, allowing people like Alan Greenspan to curtail the background to the kind of breeding ground that permitted people like Jim Cramer to do what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with him that he probably wasn't doing anything illegal, and the fact that he's bragging about it means that he's quite sure of his ground in this respect.
Indeed.
But, you know, this is where the rot sets in. This is what I hope will be written about when the historians come to put their spin on it. I rather feel that it may not be the case that they do that, because historians are well known for siding with the status quo, and of course those who don't are marginalized. So I'm not sure we'll get a fair shake out of on this in this regard. But I do think that what he did was perfectly legal, and the problem, the actual specifics of the rot that was allowed to fester on Wall Street don't begin with Cramer and his ilk. They begin with the regulators who simply didn't do their jobs.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Richard, for taking the time to answer my question.
It's a great
and
pleasure.
And I really do appreciate your show. It's
thank
very
you so much. Come back.
And informative.
Come back anytime with more questions.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I thought that I would give you a little bit more of an example about credit default swaps. The credit default swap market, which brought down AIG, which fell, as many of you will know, because it couldn't meet its obligations to customers who had bought their credit default swaps. In other words, AIG had sold people the credit default swaps, completely convinced that no event would ever happen requiring them to make good their customers on the bonds and the swaps and the obligations that lay behind those swaps. You know, the bondholders had bought them to protect themselves from default on these various different forms of debt. And when AIG couldn't meet the wave of obligations it owed on those swaps last fall, the Federal Reserve stepped in with its $85 billion loan to keep the insurer from going bankrupt. As I think it was Henry said earlier on, basically they got paid to cover their debts. The government has pledged a total of $160 billion to AIG right now to help it meet its obligations and restructure operations. Before it collapsed, in case you didn't know this, there were $440 billion in credit defaults on their books. In other words, that was the amount they owed should anything untoward happen. Many people would, of course, liken it to what happens to an insurance company when there's a major force 5 hurricane or an earthquake. But suffice it to say that its biggest customers, which were European banks and United States investment banks, had bought the swaps to insure against defaults on a wide variety of debt holdings, you know, including what we've discussed, as like the pools of mortgages, the corporate loans. And because of the way that AIG wrote its swaps, and because the company had a double A credit rating at the time, it didn't have to put up any collateral to assure its customers that it would be able to pay on the insurance if necessary. And this was perfectly legal. As I told you, the swaps were not regulated. They were not to be found on any exchanges like regular commodities and stocks, which are obliged to be passed through brokerage situations such as the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago or the New York Stock Exchange in New York or the NASDAQ, which is also a formalized exchange. Collateral would only be required with AIG if its credit rating were cut or if the debt underlying the swaps declined. But then, of course, you see, in 2008, both of those unthinkable events occurred together. And then suddenly, of course, AIG had to cough up collateral it didn't have. So you see, the rescue of AIG also involved a bailout of its many customers, none of whom the insurer or the government were willing to identify until recently. So there you have it. I mean, basically, we'll talk a lot more, and as many of these things will happen with greater frequency, I think you will come to understand how it works with these particular so-called products that were made available to people to speculate in. And, of course, as I told you, the credit default swap market involved people who had no skin in the game. They weren't necessarily protecting themselves against anything. They just stood up and said, well, I think I like this particular debt or these obligations. I'll offer some insurance against that and pick up an annual premium, and we'll be happy. And, of course, there you had maybe a particular bond over-insured 5 or 6 or 50 or 60 times. So, you know, we haven't yet seen the downside to all this. It is going to be a long time before we get to the bottom of this whole thing. And in the meantime, because of the immense amount involved, the government will be absolutely overwhelmed. It will not be able to cover these debts. It will not even try to cover them in the long run. All this credit, which is commonly known as money, will be seen and shown up for what it is, which is just hot air. And we have to assure ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, that we don't get caught in all this, which is why you do need to take drastic measures, as and when I advise you to do so. Right now, I want you to deal with the stable value fund issue. I'm pretty sure that next in line will be the commercial money market problem, but we're going to have to deal with that one too. Right. Well, I have now seen that there's a problem with my instant messaging system, and I think our show is well and truly over. So I will bid you au revoir until Monday week, and have a wonderful weekend, and I will be thinking about you on my trip. So take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.